Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll go ahead and get started. A couple things. I handed this out about 2 months ago tonight. If you still have it, you are an amazing, amazing student. We're going to try to get to that. We're going to be on page 144 of the framework book, just kind of introducing some things. We're going to be going through the book of Nehemiah tonight. As we begin, I've handed this out. This is a new copy. Oops, upside down. And if you take a look at this, a couple interesting things about this is the map at the top of the page. It's the Persian Royal Road. If you go over there in Susa, way to the east, you can see, it's south of Ecbatana. It's where one of the centers capitals, major cities of the Persian Empire. And this is where we're going to see Nehemiah is going to be at. Ecbatana is one of the places where Daniel was at. But Nehemiah and Artaxerxes, as we're going to read tonight, are in Susa. And there's a road. It goes 1,700 miles. You can see the red line going across the Tigris, Euphrates, through Cappadocia, through Asia Minor, all the way over to Sardis, which is one of the seven churches of Revelation. And that 1,700-mile road, that was a road the Persians built, or a roadway. It was they had some great advances in their, if you want to call it technology, but as they began to expand their empire. And they had stations with fresh horses every 15 miles. Again, this was not just like if you wanted to go on a vacation, but this was their mail route to communicate across the empire. So when if you find Jerusalem on there, and you've got Nehemiah or Ezra or the people sending letters back and forth to the Persian Empire, it's not like they're taking, months and months to get there. They'd pick up on, there'd be other connections, branches off of that road, so they could send letters back and forth. And in this case, they could cover that entire 1,700 miles in 7 days. It's, in a sense, the original Pony Express. And, again, it's not something the king would travel that fast, but the couriers that would be traveling, carrying letters, would be able to travel from Susa all the way over the Tigris, the Euphrates, all the way to Sardis in a matter of a week, which is pretty quick. You check your own mail system and see how it works. And that's the royal route. So that's kind of interesting to see that and realize as we continue to move into history, there's pressure coming from the West that they're off the map right there, from Greece. Eventually, Philip and Alexander, his son, Alexander the Great, are going to cross over there and start occupying those cities on the coast because they feel like they're being pressured by the Persians. And that's going to be the goat coming from the West that Daniel prophesied that's going to end up sweeping through the Persian Empire. After Artaxerxes, we're going to talk about him tonight. After Artaxerxes of Nehemiah's day, he's going to have like a 40-year reign. When he dies, the kings that follow him are corrupt, the culture is corrupt, and they move through him fairly quickly, and they become a weakened empire. And that's when Alexander comes and takes him out. That's coming in the story. Right below that, we've talked about this before, but there's a silver bowl. You can kind of see that it's sitting kind of on a mirror. And so you can see it's got like a little neck on it with a base. And that's a wine bowl that was found. You can read the details there. It's silver. It's from the days, it's the 5th century, the days that we're talking about right now. It comes from Persia. It says, and you can see there towards the bottom, you can see the cuneiform writing across the bottom. That's on the lip of the silver bowl. You recognize the wedge-shaped or trumpet-shaped writing, the cuneiform. And as you read that, of course, I can't read that, but the translation is Artaxerxes the Great King, King of Kings, King of Countries, son of Xerxes the King. And again, Xerxes would be Esther's husband, the one she married. Artaxerxes would not be her son, but it would be, her stepson, if you want to consider it that way. So, a son of Xerxes the King, of Xerxes, who was son of Darius the King, in whose royal house this silver saucer was made. That's what it says in cuneiform around that. And so this is, again, a silver wine bowl that was used in the days of Artaxerxes with his name on it, his father's name on it, and his grandfather's name on it. And as you know, Nehemiah was the cupbearer that would bring the wine. It's very likely Nehemiah handle things like this. Now, I'm not, you can't say it's got Nehemiah's fingerprints on it or anything, but this was the type of thing that when he'd bring wine in, that this would be stuff that from the days of Artaxerxes. Amazingly, again, people want to question the Bible. You've got the name of three kings right here that are referred to in the Bible, and Artaxerxes fits right into the days of the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is having a conversation with him, and so that's just kind of interesting to just kind of keep that in mind. There you have it. Again, on this map of the walls of the city of Jerusalem, I've got it started right here. We'll maybe fill this out a little bit. This is getting ready for Nehemiah when he arrives in Jerusalem. He's going to walk around or ride around this city at night and kind of inspect it. We're moving up into the year. Well, let's go ahead and I'll pray. And then if you'd open your framework books up to page 144, we'll get a little bit of a background on this because we've got the book of Ezra. We've got the book of Nehemiah. We've already talked about Haggai and Zechariah. All these are kind of interacting. I want to kind of show you how they're spaced out again as we read through Nehemiah. I'll pray, and then we'll take a look at page 144. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus. We do thank you for the opportunity to study your word, to look at the history that you provided for us. We ask that we may learn from this, that we would see your continued control of history. You're moving in the lives of people and the people that responded to you with faith, that got things done and accomplished your purpose. We ask that you would strengthen us at this time in our own hearts, in our own ministries that you've given to us, and live a life that is pleasing to you at this time. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. I would like to go back to page 144, and the year there is 520. In fact, if you just turn the page back, you can see on page 143, on the left column, you got Ezra chapter 2, Ezra chapter 3, in 537, 536. That's the time that when Ezra came over, you know, the exiles were sent back. They arrived in 538, 536. And these are the ones that were sent back, and they began to lay the foundation for the temple. They're going to receive opposition. Now, we're going way back to when the Persians had overtaken the Babylonians, and they were sent back by Cyrus. And so that's in 537, 536. Then there's going to be, after they build the altar, you can see there's going to be opposition in 536. And that's when they kind of go, whoa, this is too much. We can't do this. And they start taking care of their own lives because they're surviving in a foreign country. They weren't born there. You know, they're Jews that have returned, but they're Jews that were born in Babylon. Their parents were in Babylon. And so they've got to kind of go into survival mode there, especially getting opposition from the Samaritans. There's going to be, from 536, there's some details there about Cambyses and the different kings that followed. Turn to page 144 at the top, 520. Then in 520, and we've spent a couple weeks talking about this, Haggai and Zechariah arose. They're referred to in the book of Ezra that they arose and they began to encourage the people, meaning it's time to get started. I mean, you've been here for 20 years or 16 years, and you stop building. Well, there's opposition. It's like, is that an excuse? You've had time to build your own houses. And then Zechariah, as we looked at, brought up several encouraging messages saying, this is the time. God is going to prosper the land. The city will once again be a city without walls. But you've got to get started. It's going to expand. So that's 520. Because they heard the word of Zechariah and Haggai, the people took heart and got started on the temple again. There was some opposition, but they worked against it. And they by 516, you can see in the year 516, the temple was rebuilt. 70 years after it had been destroyed by the Babylonians. And that's in Ezra chapter 6, verse 13 through 18. Now, there's several things that take place. Then again, you've got the Battle of Marathon, different things historically taking place at the bottom. But the temple is built by 516. And that was kind of the ministry of Zechariah, the visions that he saw to encourage the people. And so they've got the temple built by 516. So now you realize you're going to have a large gap from 516. We got 490. We've got a lot of, you know, Xerxes comes in. And go over to page 145, years 481, 479. You got the Battle of Thermopylae, Salamis. This is when Xerxes, as Daniel prophesied, Xerxes, there's going to be a king that will arise and stir up the Greeks. He's going to go over there, and this is the movie 300. He attacks the Greeks and tries to, you know, drive them out. He's trying to conquer Macedonian Greece, and the Greeks hold him off and drive him back. He comes back defeated. And this is all then in Esther. He comes back in the year 478, 474. This is when he already set aside his queen and now he's got to find a new queen. That's when the story of Esther takes place. You can see in 478, 474, there's your story of Esther. Then 465, Artaxerxes begins to reign along with his father. Artaxerxes is assassinated. Excuse me. Xerxes is assassinated, and that was something Mordecai had warned him about one time. And so there's a continuous conspiracy. So Artaxerxes begins to reign. Now in 464, you've got Ezra chapter 4. A couple things taking place. There's still, they're trying to rebuild the city. They send a letter over to Artaxerxes saying, hey, these are rebellious people. So there they're going to go and try and find some records. And there's a very important line right there in Ezra chapter 4, verse 21. Artaxerxes, the king we're talking about tonight, who's going to be with Nehemiah, he says, the city will not be rebuilt until I so order. They're going to go check, because it's like, they don't know exactly what Cyrus had said. A lot of history had gone by, and there's been a report, a court case filed against the Jews. He says, okay, stop it. Let me investigate, find out what's going on here. Because, I mean, if you look at this map, I mean, they've got a big empire they're ruling. They're not just worrying about Jerusalem. They got a whole lot of other email servers that they've got to investigate and find out, you know, the emails that have been hidden or whatever. So they got a lot of other things to take place or worry about. Now, it doesn't take long. By 458, Artaxerxes, now we're into Ezra chapter 7, verse 8 and 9. And these are important verses eschatologically because he does decree to rebuild the city. They found the records and they say, okay, you may go ahead and begin to rebuild the city. And that's in Ezra chapter 7. And that's the year 458. So when you start, again, this is just, you know, 458. Sometimes 445 is the year to be used. But this is when he says, okay, you can go ahead and begin rebuilding the city. When it says, when it starts counting down to 483 years, this might be the date you want to start from. Sometimes people use 445 when we're coming to. But that was Daniel's prophecy, the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. Artaxerxes says, stop building it. You can start when I say so. They investigated, found some court records, and he gives the okay. And that may be the countdown, the beginning of the countdown, beginning in 458. And that's, again, recorded in Ezra 10, and it's referenced to Daniel chapter 9. Turn the page again, please. Now we're on page 146, and at the top it says 457. Ezra, by this time, now notice how many years between the beginning of the book of Ezra, which starts in 536, records information into 520, 516, and now look at the date here, 457. Now Ezra is in Jerusalem. So when we're looking at the early dates of the chapters of Ezra, Ezra's recording history. He's not recording things that he saw because he's not going to be there until this time in history, if you understand what I'm saying. So he's recording things that have already taken place before he arrived. And when he gets there, in Ezra chapter 10, verse 17, he's going to set up a committee. They're going to investigate into the intermarriage. We've talked about that. And then now we're going to begin chapter Nehemiah, the book of Nehemiah, in 446. So now, Ezra has gone back to this city, or he's arrived in the city. He realizes the people are not following the law. The law is not being followed, the intermarrying. They've got the temple has been rebuilt, but it's kind of been renting rooms out to some of the Gentiles. They need some structure. They don't really even know, in a sense, the Old Testament law. And Ezra is a scribe. He's trained in Old Testament. So he's going to come in here and see this as a disaster. And he's going to have to purify the temple as far as getting the priesthood cleaned up. He's going to have to purify the people, getting rid of the Gentiles that have moved in and married in with the Jews. So that is what Ezra is doing at this time. Again, as we know, people are communicating back and forth from Jerusalem with Susa, as you can see on the map. And Nehemiah now is in the palace of Artaxerxes. He's the wine bearer. He's the cupbearer. He's one of the guys that works. He's not just a servant that carries, you know, drinks back and forth and cleans off the tables. He's got some kind of royal capacity. He's got some kind of training, more than just, you know, a waiter. And so we're in chapter, on page 146, the year is 446. November, December, right in that month, Nehemiah is in Susa, and here's a report from a Jew from Jerusalem that the walls of Jerusalem have not been rebuilt. Now, here's the issue. 538, Babylon falls to Persia. Cyrus says, you may go back. 536 B.C., they arrive with Zerubbabel, and they lay the foundation, they begin building. There's opposition, so they stop. Zechariah and Haggai arise in 520 and say, hey, God says, get this stuff done. What are you waiting for? The Jews say, oh, yeah, we got to get it done. By 516, the temple is rebuilt, up and running. Now the year is 446. Do you see the difference? 446. 538, they come back. 520, they're encouraged to re-engage the building of the temple, and it's built by 516. That's a 22-year run from being told to go back and actually finishing the temple. That's 516. Now they sit back again, and nothing really takes place. Ezra shows up right around this same time and realizes no one's following the law. They're renting rooms out to the Samaritans. There's Samaritans and Gentiles in the temple. They're completely lost as a people as far as following the law. So you've got now, you know, some 70 years, you know, just roughly here, between the time of the temple being done until the days Ezra actually arrives. And now someone shows up back in Susa, and Nehemiah, who is a Jew, who's aware of these things, who's a faithful Jew, who's excited to know that Daniel has prayed, the people have gone back, Jeremiah's prophecy has been fulfilled, the 70 years are fulfilled, and they're back. He's got a vision for his people. God's restoring his people. So here comes a Jew back from Jerusalem over to Susa. Hey, how's it going? Yeah, not real good. There's no walls. The walls that we did get built, they got burnt during this opposition period. Maybe he mentions Ezra. Ezra's back, and it's like people aren't following the law. It's like it's a disaster. And so all that hope, just like you're hoping for, you know, the second coming, or you're hoping for God to bring revival through this next election, and all of a sudden you've been praying, you've been waiting, you've been watching things develop, and all of a sudden, no, there's the country's going off record again. They've gone even further. It's like, I mean, your hope is gone. Your hope is that. It's like it's been almost 100 years, and we haven't even progressed except to build a temple that we're not even using correctly. So Nehemiah is crushed. I mean, this is what he's living for. He's a Jew in a foreign country, but he knows everything's fine because this is being rebuilt. We're coming back on the map as a people. God's will is being done. Then he finds out, no, it's not. And so that's kind of where we pick up now in Nehemiah. And so you've got to kind of understand, if you would please, go to the book of Nehemiah. You got to kind of understand Nehemiah's emotion, that he's not looking at this as an individual for his individual salvation. He's looking at this as his people coming back, and he believes the promise to Abraham. He believes in the law. He believes Jeremiah's prophecy. He believes in Daniel's prophecy. He believes that the temple is up and running and things are back on track. We're being restored just like God said. But then he finds out it's going backwards. So here we go, chapter 1. This would be the year 446 B.C. And again, you kind of get a feel for how many years it's been. I mean, this until you break this down, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, all these books, Malachi, get jumbled together. And yet, if you can separate them, it's a pretty rhythmic, we've got dates. Well, right away, we start off. Here we go, chapter 1, Nehemiah. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, which would be our November, December, in the 20th year while I was in the citadel of Susa. Now, citadel would mean it's a royal fortress. It's similar where Daniel would hang out at. So he's in the royal palace. He's in the royal fortress. The year would be November, December, 446. And you probably got something similar in your footnotes. One of my brothers, now again, does this mean a literal brother? Maybe. Or does this mean, again, if it may be a brother, because they may, you know, their family may have been moved up into some kind of rank of educated, you know, Jews serving in the palace or the citadel of the Persians. But nonetheless, it's a Jew. One of my brothers came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. How are things going? The people that have gone back that survived the exile, they've returned. How's the city? How's the remnant doing? I mean, they're our hope. They're the ones that are, they're the seed that Jeremiah said would come back and rebuild the city. They said to me, those who survived the exile and are back in the province of the great are in great trouble and disgrace. They survived the exile, come to Babylon. They survived the 70 years and they've gone back. Yes, those, they've gone back, but they're in great trouble and disgrace, meaning they're physically in danger, but they're also they're embarrassed. I mean, it's like they're not even a people. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, of course, is broken down by Nehemiah, but any kind of rebuilding they've done has been demolished by the Samaritans or the Gentile opposition. And its gates have been burnt with fire. And again, that's probably referring to the opposition you see in Ezra chapter 4 that Ezra talks about in this time period, where they came down and says, stop building the city, and they burnt down what was done. Now again, the walls, the gates would be stone, but then they would have wooden framework around it to hang doors and hinges for the doors to move. Even today, you don't have stone gates. You've got a stone frame going around it, but then the gates themselves would be wooden. So that's the part that is burnt. The functioning part of the gate, you still maybe have a wooden structure or a stone structure, but it doesn't do any good because the wooden gates are burnt down. Now, here's Nehemiah's response. When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days, I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, now, if you remember Daniel's prayer, when he realized after reading the book of Jeremiah that the 70 years had been fulfilled, if you remember his prayer, he began to confess the sins of his people. This is very similar. So he's wept, he's mourned, and now he prays. This is Nehemiah praying. O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and obey his commandments. Know where he goes right to the covenant. Goes right to the covenant that God has established with Abraham through the law of Moses that, you know, Jeremiah spoke about, that Daniel called God to account for. It 70 years is up. It's time to go back. First thing he goes, we're coming to you based on the covenant. Not because we're any better than anybody else, but you chose us. We've got a covenant with you. Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. So again, he says, I'm praying for these people or the whole nation of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's house, have committed against you. Again, notice how community-centered this is. The sins of the people, his own sins, and the sins of his father's household. Meaning, I mean, we're all, you know, my father's sin, my dad, we're in this together. We, you know, we're being judged because of the sin of the people that came before us. We've been restored because of the covenant you gave to Abraham, the Mosaic covenant, we're restored, and now we're the ones responsible, so we're all building together. I mean, they've got a past, and they're going to a future. It's not quite as individualistic sometimes as we look at it. You know, I'm saved, I've got a personal relationship, when I die, I'm going to go to heaven. Good luck. You know, it's like they see themselves rising and falling as a community. And again, that's not, we're not completely foreign to that, but they're pretty tied into it, pretty tight. We have acted wickedly toward you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. So they've been waiting for this. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling place for my name. Again, that's clearly a reference. I mean, you got to decide. For me, it's clearly a reference of physically being scattered to the furthest Gentile nation. God says, I will gather them back to the place I've chosen, which is Jerusalem, the place he set his name. Now, you can allegorize that if you want to, but there's no way Nehemiah is allegorizing that to mean anything other than the physical people of Israel being scattered to the Gentile nations and brought back someday to Jerusalem. That's the only way he's understanding it. Again, that's me speaking. I might be wrong. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeem by your great strength and your mighty hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was the cupbearer to the king. So again, that he had a position with the king. And you're going to find him speaking with the king here. So, and again, we got to realize and be careful as you put this together. You may want to study it on your own. But he's not just cleaning off the tables, wiping up the spilled drinks, and bringing in some, you know, kind of get you a refill. There's because he's going to be unleashed with 12 years of freedom, of responsibility, given access to records and finances. So this man is able to manage more than just cleaning off a table and bringing more refills, not making fun of, you know, waiters or anything. But when the king asks him, what do you need, he is able to categorize, well, here we go. He's able to answer the question very thoroughly. Someone that's familiar with budgets, supplies, building programs, and organizing committees and people. And when you see Nehemiah get over to Jerusalem, you can tell this guy is not just a waiter. This guy is, we might call him a community leader or something. Okay, here we go. Chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year, now this would be 445, this is 4 months later. So we've gone 4 months. So we can assume that possibly he's heard this report and he's been dragging it with him for 4 months. Has he been out of the king's service for 4 months? Maybe, you know, it's his turn to come in. I don't know the details, but it's been 4 months since he's heard. And now it says in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. So the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. So you almost, it's like, you wonder what kind of relationship they've had. I'm going to assume they've had some kind of personal conversations. Not personal in the sense, well, how's your family, how's the kids? But, you know, well, what do you think about this project? Or what's your information? What do you know? What's your research show you? They've dealt, so he can look him in the eye and say, wait, there's nothing wrong. You're not sick, and yet you're not focused, Nehemiah. What's wrong? And again, this king being, the Persian king with some serious authority, as you know, you've heard it taught before, Nehemiah responds, I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? So again, going back to his fathers, meaning we've got this continuity coming from our fathers. They were buried there in hope of being restored someday. And now we've been almost 100 years back trying to get this thing done. And we made no progress. He says, why? And he's kind of spilling the beans right here. I was very much afraid, meaning my next words could cost me my position, my life, my next word. And it's like, I almost feel like he said, I was very much afraid, but I thought, what the heck? I mean, who wants to live if this is the condition? Similar to what Mordecai and maybe Esther, it's like, hey, maybe it's for such a time as this. If you're not going to put your head on the line for something like this, you're not worthy of being called a Jew in this case. Meaning, your fathers are buried there, your people have gone back, and now you're standing in the presence of the king, able to voice the issue, and you're afraid of your job being lost, you're afraid of your life being lost. It's like, so I was very much afraid, but I thought, well, what else is there? This is why I'm here. So I said, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when my city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? And again, that fire would probably be the Samaritan or Gentile opposition during the days that Ezra wrote about here when before the temple was built. Now watch the king. Watch Artaxerxes. This is the king who rules this map. You know, this Persian, this route right here. He's got the, wherever that Pony Express goes, he has jurisdiction. So he says, well, the king says, what is it you want? Meaning, well, what's your plan? You must have been thinking about it. I know how your mind works, Nehemiah. You've already figured this all out, what you need. How would you fix this problem? Again, this is your typical, what would you say, someone comes to the boss with a problem. I've got a complaint. I don't like this. One of the best responses of the boss is like not defend your position. It's like, okay, well, what would you do about it? Well, I don't know. I just don't like the way it is. It's like, well, go back to work, son. It's like, well, okay, if you've got a complaint, you must have been thinking about it. How would you resolve it? Have you been thinking about it, or are you just a complainer? And in this case right here, Nehemiah knows right here, he says, the king asks, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. It's like, okay, God, here it is. This is what I've been mourning for, maybe for 4 months, been weeping, fasting, mourning, praying. And now the emperor has just asked me, how do you resolve to fix this? Okay, it's go time. Because he's listening. The king has the power to say, stamped, approved, go get it done. I'll give you 12 years. Or you can say, no, go get back to work. We'll do it some other way. So he said, I prayed to the Lord, I answered the king. If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. I mean, is that guts or what? I mean, or is that confidence? I mean, the guy's not, again, he's not just, you know, cleaning off tables. It's like, I can fix this problem. If you will give me the papers, I'll go fix the city. I'll rebuild it. It's like, what, he's going to go out there with his hammer and start building the city? No, he's going to go over there and start setting up a system and get the job done. Then the king and the queen, sitting beside him, now we realize the queen is there by Artaxerxes, asked me, how long will your journey take and when will you get back? How long is it going to take you to go to Jerusalem, rebuild the city, and get back here? How much time do you need? I mean, I don't know. couple months, I really haven't thought about it. He said, how long would it take you? If it pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. It appears that time was 12 years. So he gives him the answer. I also said to him, if it pleases the king, in other words, I need about 12 years. It doesn't say it in the text, but that's how long he's going to have freedom, because he's got to check back in, and he's going to come back a little bit later. So he's going to be in Jerusalem for a lengthy time period. But not only does he want to get there, it's like, what good am I going to do if I get there? I'm going to need some supplies. So I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. In other words, I'm going to have to go through several cities, several gates, several clearances. Can you give me safe passage? When I get there, they don't execute me as being a traitor, but I can show them papers, passports. So that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams of the gates, for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. In other words, I need timber for my rebuilding of my house, my palace. And again, like I've said before, it appears the city that he... Again, this is the Temple Mount right here. This is where the temple is. This is the original city of David right here. This is what is called the Ophel. That's that land between, the Temple Mount and the city of David. David's palace, if we understand this correctly, there's a little bit of debate, but I think it's pretty worthless. This is the large stone structure that appears to be the Jebusite fortress. It's in the right place to defend the city. David occupied it. It's been rediscovered. It's a large stone structure, meaning it's not a house. It's not a residence. It's some kind of governmental building. It's been reinforced. There's been all the boule and things that match the names of people that were in the king's service during the days of Jeremiah have been found in this general location in the burnt out part from the days of Babylon. We also have found a boule, a stamp or a seal with the name of a woman that matches the name of Nehemiah's daughter with Persian symbols on it and Persian references. So in other words, it appears he moved. And is Nehemiah of Persian culture? The answer is yes. He's a Jew, but he's of Persian culture because he was born in Persia. He's grown up in Persia. He's serving the Persian king in the Persian palace. So his family is, in a sense, if he shows up, you'd look, oh, there's a Persian. No, that's Nehemiah the Jew. It's like, well, why does he look like a Persian? Because he is a Persian. I mean, he comes from Persia. So that's all been located. So it appears he's rebuilding this city right here. He wants some wood to build some of the gates around the city here. So this is many of these things are very easy to make a connection archaeologically. Again, he says, give me timber to make the beams. I'm in verse 8. Beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my request. Once again, he's in line with what we saw in the book of Zechariah. Zechariah was encouraging the people, go out and build, you will be successful. Because what Jeremiah was telling you, God is going to tear the city down, Zechariah is saying, the time has come to build the city. Why is it not being built? Because you're not asking, you're not doing anything. Nehemiah is in that same position. God wants to build this city back up. And Nehemiah is just stepping out saying, here's what I need. And because this is God's will, the gracious hand of God was with him. This is not because Nehemiah is a great man. Jeremiah was a great man, and his message was, tear the city down. Nehemiah is at the right place, the right time, and this is God's will. And God says, I want you to ask, and I will do it. And so that's what takes place. The gracious hand of God was upon me, he says. The king granted my request. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates. Again, that would be we've talked about this before. On the other side, if you look on the map I handed out tonight, if you look on the west side of the Euphrates, that's the Trans-Euphrates. That means on the other side of the Euphrates. Like when you look at the map of Israel, Trans-Jordan is on the east side of the Jordan. It's on the other side. It's Moab and Edom. It's Bashan. It's on the east side, Trans-Jordan. This is now when you're in Susa and you're Trans-Euphrates, you're talking about the land on the other side of the Euphrates. So he's going to travel over to the other side of the Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. Now, do you understand? Sometimes, just because we don't think about it, or at least I talk about myself, we think Nehemiah is going to ride in on a horse or something and come walk in and say, well, I'm here. Where do I stay? When he comes in with a cavalry. He comes in with royal horses. It's like, who is this? Is this the Persian king? It looks like one of the Persian kings. Who is this? This is Nehemiah the Jew. He's come to rebuild the city. So he comes in with a full Persian escort as if he is the king himself coming into the city. Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, this is just not some guy that was a slave that cleaned up the floor and wiped the tables off. We read this again. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite, now this is the governor of Samaria. They're the ones up north. They're the governors. They've got their own little kingdom up here. They don't want this kingdom. It'd affect the economy. It'd affect the reputation. They would have more people here because this is the ancient city. Samaria wants to keep this thing buried, keep it bound up in court. So now he's going to meet when Sanballat, and don't forget that name, Sanballat the Horonite, and Tobiah, the Ammonite official, heard about this. They were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. Not just another Jew showing up, but a Jew that had Persian documentation that was from the Persian court itself. Okay, now, Chad, that's when he arrived. So now Samaria knows, because he would have went right by him. It's like, who is this? This is Nehemiah. He works with Artaxerxes. He's here with government support. It's like, yes, sir. Sanballat and Tobiah. This would be 445 B.C. Yep. No, that's okay. And it's probably, if you have a study Bible, it would be in the references down here. Now, those names, Sanballat and Tobiah, are going to be repeated over the next several hundred years because they're going to be common names. So they're going to pop up again. So kind of keep that in mind. Don't be confused because there are going to be some Jews are going to be named Tobiah and stuff. Okay, so now he's in the city. Chapter 2, verse 11. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. So again, you can imagine the journey. He takes 3 days to recover, gets everything set in order, probably has meetings with people, let everybody know he's there and what he's, you know, a little bit about what he's doing there. But they don't know all the details because he doesn't want a big commotion. He doesn't want to expose everything to his opposition. And that's why you have, and you've heard this taught before, that's why you've got the night visit to the walls right here. I set out, verse 12, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. He's just a Persian government official who happens to be Jewish who shows up and is just probably talked with Ezra, spoke with a few people. It's like, and he hasn't really showed his hand yet. It's like, glad to have you here. Oh, I'm not sure necessarily how long I'm going to be here. Maybe he hasn't revealed everything. So now he goes out at night and he's going to walk around this gate. Now, this is why I handed this map out to you many, many weeks ago to get this place right here. So, I know. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. In other words, he's got a few men with him, but he's the only one on a horse. So the other men are just kind of, they're probably there to protect him. He doesn't want a big commotion. It's at night, so no one can watch. What were you doing down there, Nehemiah? He doesn't want a bunch of horses because one horse is, you know, people traveling a horse or just traveling somewhere. You know, 5, 6, 10, 12 horses. It's like, what's going on down there? It's just a man on a horse with a few guys walking with him. So that's what's happening. Very discreet. Verse 13, by night I went out through the valley gate down towards the jackal wall. So if we look on your map, and again, I've made this map, as have several people. If you look on this gate, this map right here, I'm trying to find the place right here. The jackal gate, when you talk about this, let's go back and look at this here. By night I went out through the jackal gate. The jackal gate is going to be probably on kind of where I've got marked on here, the valley gate. He's going to go out down in here. He's going out on this side of the city. And this, you can kind of follow this because this is the Pool of Siloam right here. It's going to be called, right now, this is where it's going to be referred to jackals. And there's going to be a lot of, you know, animals coming here to get water because, again, their walls are not here. This is where the walls used to be. Where they're going to be expanded. So he's going out over on this side here, and he's going to be going around the city through this direction. So you can kind of follow your map there. How many of you have got a map in your Bible already that some, like a study Bible, you've already got some kind of a map right there on that page? You may have right there. Not necessarily, maybe in the back, but sometimes you've got them. Like, see, I've got one right here at the bottom of my map, my study Bible right here. So anyway, that's just kind of fun to follow this. So anyway, by now they went out through the valley gate, towards the jackal well and the dung gate. So here would be the valley gate towards the jackal well which is probably has something to do with the Pool of Siloam. Remember, over here is the Gihon Springs. Here's the Gihon Springs. Hezekiah has cut the tunnel through the bedrock, and it empties into here. It flows, even flows today, into the Pool of Siloam. So it was flowing in 700 B.C. It's flowing in 2015. You can go there. Some of us have walked through the water. It was still flowing in this day, although this Pool of Siloam may not have been. It was the what we see today, the Pool of Siloam, is Herodian. It's the where the water comes out. But Herod had it built up and matched many of the pools of his time. So what we see today as the Pool of Siloam isn't there, but the water is coming to that pool. You understand what I'm saying? It's like there's a water source there, but it might just be a pool of water. Herod's going to build it up so you got steps coming down so as it, well, you know, so it rises and falls. It looks like a swimming pool in a sense. Of course, we can't see all of it. It hasn't all been excavated. So in other words, the water source is draining into here. So when you say the jackal well, it's probably where this water's draining into here. We're assuming. But anyway, there's some kind of a pool right here. And that's probably the Pool of Siloam. So we're kind of on the south side. And then it says, and the dung gate. And if you look on there, you can see the dung gate would be down on this side. And the dung gate is where all the city waste would be taken. All the you know, it's always going to be to the south, most likely, because there's a Hinnom Valley down there, and they're going to dump it out on this side. So Valley Gate, the Pool of Siloam, they're going around here, went down by the dung gate. And he's just inspecting. He's just inspecting. Examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved on towards the fountain gate. Now, the fountain gate here, if we would continue this direction, he's moving on through the Hinnom Valley here, picks up the Kidron Valley, and moves up this way to the fountain gate. And this is another, the original water source, the Gihon Springs, which still bubbles water today. This would be the fountain gate. When people would come out to get water, they'd go over here to the fountain to get water. Again, we talked about this before in Solomon's day. Even there still remains of it. There's water would be just drained into here into different channels to water this part of the Kidron Valley for the king's garden. So this would be the fountain gate here for people to get water. Hezekiah took it over here so they had more water because the city had expanded over on the western side. So this is where he's going through. He comes up to, now he's at the Gihon Springs. Again, it doesn't say that exactly, but it's got to kind of all kind of match. The fountain gate and the king's pool. Again, what's the king's pool? Well, it can be in this area here where the king's gardens were. But there was not enough room for my mount to get through, so I went up the valley by night examining the wall. In other words, he has to get off of his horse. Now, if you've been here and again, or looked at pictures, imagine when we stood in David's palace or the remains of David's palace and looked out in the Kidron Valley over here at Silwan. And that's the steep drop-off. And that whole city has been, from the days of the destruction, has been pushed off into the Kidron Valley. When you stand there, you can look down what we call the Jebusite Wall. It's like a terrace wall that was built up. You're looking straight down. And so he's coming through that area, and all that rubble has been just pushed down, so he can't ride his horse through this area. It's too full of rubble and just destroyed walls. So he gets off and leads his horse through this area, looking at the destruction layer that has never been rebuilt. Remember, they've come back, they've got the temple built, but the city hasn't been rebuilt. It's a lot of work. So he's got to get off, as he's coming up the Kidron Valley, he's got to get off the horse. So I went up the valley, the Kidron Valley. I'm in verse 15. So I went up the Kidron Valley. He's going up this way, the Kidron Valley, by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or the officials or any others who would be doing the work. In other words, I'm still making plans. He gets up. This is his first night. He goes up here. It's like, oh my gosh. And comes back. It's like, okay, I've seen enough for one night. This is going to be some work. So that's what he does. Verse 17, then I said to them, you see that this is when now he's ready to talk with them. He says, you see, this is his speech. This is his promotion speech. He calls a meeting. Now he's going to get them fired up, so we got to get this done. And he's going to be able to reveal to them that I've got some strings. I've got some connections. I can get this done. He's got the desire. He's got God's covenant, God's will. He's got the connections to the Persians, and he's got the personality. Now he's just got to convince the people, don't work against me. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and its gates have been burnt with fire. Meaning every time you start to build, they come down and burn it down. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace from the world, but particularly from the Samaritans who are keeping us oppressed. I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. Probably reminded them of the covenant, maybe read some verses or referred to Daniel's prophecy and Jeremiah's prophecy. But basically says, if you doubt that, look at this letter. Look who it's signed by. Artaxerxes himself. Oh, you know Artaxerxes? I work for Artaxerxes. I talked to him about this already. You've talked to Artaxerxes? Yeah, look, here's a selfie we've got on Facebook together. It's like, okay, it's like, wow. Okay, they replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. In other words, they buy into it right away. Meaning, he's not just blowing smoke at them. He's got connections. It's like, okay, let's get it done. And of course, now what's going to happen? They go, okay, let's get this done. How many times have you heard that? Let's get it done. What's going to happen as soon as they start? Next verse. You know what's going to happen. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite, official, and Gesem the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you are doing, they asked. Are you rebelling against the king? Aha, see, that's their play. You're rebelling against the king. It's like, and you're a rebellious city, we're going to report you. But they know it's going to happen. If they report him, it's kind of like Artaxerxes says, well, let's read this. I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. We, his servants, will start rebuilding. But as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim or historic right to it. Does that sound contemporary? Let me read that one more time. We, his servants, will start rebuilding, but as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem. You have no covenant here or any claim. You have never been here. We were always here. Or any historic right to it. So move on. Okay, chapter 3. Now we're going to have part of his plan, and this can get a little tedious right here, but we can use the map. Part of his plan is each family or different groups of families will take a portion of the wall, and they from gate to gate, they will begin to rebuild it. And they'll have crews. Instead of just having one group rebuild it, all the different crews will start building their portion of the wall. So I'm going to read through this, and again, this is where that map can be useful. It's kind of redundant, kind of boring information, but yet for me, it's exciting because all of a sudden, when it starts talking about these locations, we know where these locations are, and so it matches this map. It fits. So Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow servants went to work rebuilding the sheep gate. Now, if you look on the sheep gate, you can begin to follow that. See the sheep gate? Again, remember, these are the priests. They're starting right up in here. They began rebuilding the sheep gate. They dedicated it and set its doors in place, rebuilding as far as the Tower of the Hundred. And if you notice the Tower of the Hundred, it's drawn on there. They began here, and they're going to be going this way. And these are different things that have been identified as far as, you know, what they're for. There's going to be prisons. There's going to be access routes. And that's as far as they're building. I really want to spend more time developing this, but we got to keep going. Which they dedicated as far as to the Tower of Haniel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zaccur, son of Imri, built next to him. The fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hashina. They laid its beams and put its doors and bolts and bars in place. So notice again the wood that's being used. They're going to have hinges, but there's going to be doors that are going to be moving. They're putting bars in it. And the fish gate, you can see right there, that's next to the Tower of Hanel going this way. Probably, it's easy to call this the fish gate because this is where the fish would come in from the Mediterranean trade routes. So the fish gate. I lost my place here. What verse am I in here? Okay, there it is. Okay. They laid its beams. Next to him was Meshulam, son of Berechiah, the son of Shezbel, made repairs. And next to him, Zadok, son of Bana, also made repairs. And next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa. And their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisor. In other words, the people of Tekoa, which is a city where the prophet Amos came from, they came up and they began building part of the wall. But their supervisors or their elders, their leaders of the city, say we're not going to get involved in this, probably because of some political advantage they had, or they don't want to be doing this kind of a work or a rebellion or something. They had their excuse, and so they would not cooperate. The Jeshanah gate was repaired by Joiada, son of Peshel, Meshulam. I'm destroying these names. They laid its, notice again, laid its beams, that'd be the top wood, put its doors and bolts and bars in place. Next to them, repairs were made by the men of Gibeon. And again, that's making sense because Gibeon is up to the north here. And Mizpah, which is to the north, placing the authority of the governor of Trans-Euphrates. Now, it goes down to, so I can spare you a little bit. It says, they restored, in verse 8, right before verse 9, they restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. And now this is pretty easy to identify, because the broad wall is going to come out right about here. This, if you remember, coming out this way, this broad wall, forget this wall for right now, say. But back in Hezekiah's day, he built a wall out this way and wrapped up the city on this to the western side, built a wall around it. Part of this broad wall can be seen today, and you see pictures of it. Many of you have seen this broad wall. We know its measurements. You can see it. You can see it's in this very location. So this broad wall would have butted up against here to keep these people protected around 700 B.C., back when the Assyrians were invading northern Israel. And Hezekiah had built this. So they built around this, coming all the way up to reaching this broad wall up into this point right there on that side. Continuing here very quickly, goes on, talks about some more people. It says in verse 11, Melchijah, son of Hiram, and Hashub, the son of Pahath, Moab, repaired another section, and the Tower of the Ovens. And the Tower of the Ovens would, if we were continuing this way, the Tower of Ovens would be right here. And that's interesting because now you're in the middle of the city. This is where the baking's going to go. When you go to a When you go and look at the Temple Mount, if you go to the western wall, again, we're talking about the Temple Mount, the western wall, for example, of Herod's day, which would be still stands right here. And this is where Robinson's Arch is, and Larry and I, we came underneath the ground. We walked from here underneath, all the way underground, from the Pool of Siloam. We walked up underneath here, underground, and came up out of the gutter right here under Robinson's Arch. All these buildings right here, many of them have got ovens in them. There's big flat circles that they were used for ovens. And, you know, I didn't know what they were at first, but I've done some research and people have identified. This is where the baking was done in the New Testament times. And so it's interesting. It says right here where the oven talks about the Tower of the Ovens. Read verse 12. Shalem, son of Helohesh, ruler of half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. You know, go girls. Verse 13, the valley gate. Now again, where's the valley gate? That's where we started at right here. The valley gate was repaired by, and gives you the list of people that did that. They also repaired 500 yards of the wall as far as the dung gate. So from here, they repaired this gate. Then they repaired the wall from the valley gate all the way down to the dung gate. So notice they're building gates and repairing walls. The dung gate was repaired by, now this gate has to be rebuilt, so they're, you know, again, the stone structure has to be either repaired or it may still be there, but the wood part is the gate that they can shut it and keep the people out, the invaders out. So the dung gate's being built. And then verse 15, the fountain gate was repaired by Shalom. And so now the fountain gate was right, that goes back to his original night trip. He also repaired the wall. I'm still in verse 15, I guess. He also repaired the wall of the Pool of Siloam by the king's garden as far as the steps going down from the city of David. So again, there's some steps coming down here. Beyond him, Nehemiah, the ruler of half-district of Beth-Zur, made repairs up to the point of the opposite, the tombs of David as far as the artificial pool and the house of the heroes. So some of these things, it's interesting right there, the tombs of David, or the tomb of David and the kings. Peter refers to David's tomb being with him. So down in this area somewhere is the tomb of David. Of course, we've got some idea of where it's at, but it's been cut away, quarried away to use the stones by other people that were rebuilding at other times in history. So that's pretty much gone. But notice Nehemiah is right in this area doing his work. And where is Nehemiah's residence? I'm saying it's right here that he moved into the former palace and rebuilt it as his residence, because he is kind of like the governor of the city. Verse 17, next to him, the repairs were made by the Levites. Why the Levites? Because by this time, we're getting back up towards the temple area. He goes through and talks about all of them and the people that are doing the work there. I'm going to verse 22. The repairs next to him were made by the priest from the surrounding region. They gave all the details there. Then it talks about in verse 25, worked opposite the angle and the tower projecting from the upper palace near the court of the guard. Next to him, it goes to the, notice right here, I'm going to read this part here in verse 25. Next to him, Padiah, son of Parosh, and the temple servants living on the hill of Ophel. Again, this is the Ophel right here, rising from the city. This is all going uphill to Mount Moriah. So there's people, notice we're talking Levites, priests, and the servants living in this area of the Ophel, made repairs up to the point opposite the water gate. The water gate would be coming back down towards here, the fountain gate, towards the east and projecting tower. Next to them were the men of Tekoa, repaired another section, the great projecting tower to the wall of Ophel. Verse 28, above the horse gate, the priest made repairs each in front of his own house. And if you see, I've got the horse gates put on there, off the Ophel right here. So now the priests are living in this area on the Ophel, so they got easy access to the Temple Mount. And now they're doing this part of the repair. Again, it's kind of a boring section, but it's kind of neat. I like it because it brings us into not just a weird, strange document. You go and excavate these things. In fact, there's a part of the wall right here that you can still see today that's called Nehemiah's Wall. It's clearly dated to the days of the Persians, and it's a very square. You can tell the difference between the ancient walls, Nehemiah's walls, and then the walls that were built by the Maccabees in different times, and then the Herodian walls. It's similar, but it's different kind of building. And you can definitely see part of the wall that was built during this time period just near the Jebusite wall. We continue going up after the horse gate in verse, right in end of verse 29. It talks about the guard at the east gate made repairs. This would be the east gate. And right here today, this is the eastern gate right here, the golden gate, which has nothing to do with gold. It's a mistranslation, but it's the eastern gate. So we'd be right about in here. Then you're going down to verse 31 next to him. Melchijah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs as far as the house of the temple servants and the merchants opposite the inspection gate. And the inspection gate, you're going up there towards the north. It's also called the prison gate right here. That may be where your sacrifices would have been inspected as you're bringing them into the temple courts. It's an inspection gate. And as far as the room above the corner, between the room and above the corner of the sheep gate would be in the same place. Now notice on your map right there, what's just north of the sheep gate is right up here. It's the sheep pool up here, or the shepherd's pool. This is the pool of Bethesda. Where Jesus, by Jesus' time, it was had pillars and there's five colonnades. In other words, it was built, this isn't drawn correctly, but there is five colonnades. One, now colonnades is like a sidewalk with pillars with a roof on it. You know, like you like to have on your sidewalk. You know, you walk in, it's very nice. So there's pillars on this side with a roof, pillars on this side with a roof, so you can walk around here. So there's one, two, three, four, five right there. John records that. And it's been excavated. They find it exactly there. So this pool has always been here. In fact, they use it for the temple services. It's always been here. It's just by the time even in Nehemiah's day, it's probably just a pool. It's just a water supply. But in the New Testament, by Herod's time, they built it up very nice. And so that's where the man was laying and Jesus walked. And there's many crippled people laying here because the water were stirred. They think they're going to get healed. But this you can still see the remains of the New Testament building around that pool right there. So, yes, ma'am. Not true. But that I think that's kind of the issue because this is going to get done in like 50. What is it? 50? Doesn't even know off the top. What? 52 days. But this is all done in 52 days. So it's more about A to B is yours. B to C is yours. And, of course, you're going to have something consistent, building style, building materials. But it's not going to be, when you talk about Herodian walls, now we're talking magnificent. Everything's in design. There's going to be an edge around those stones and blocked up. So when you walk, you go, wow, nice wall. This is more like protection. So I'm not sure about blueprints as much as it sounds like directions that you're in charge of this area. So it probably was some kind of, you know, building coordination, but I think it was more about getting the job done And that's one of the things you can tell in certain parts is when you start comparing this to the Hasmonean building, then to the Herodian stones, it's different. Then you come in, then you're going to have, well, you know, they're not the last people to build here. You know, then after the Romans destroy it, then they're going to have, the Christians are going to come build, the Byzantines are going to come build, the Muslims are going to come build. So you've got, even when you go look, oh, look at these, must be the original walls. Like, even the walls today that go around Jerusalem here were built in 1517 by Suleiman the Great, or Suleiman the Magnificent, one of the Ottoman rulers. So it's like, oh, these must be the walls that Jesus saw. No, those walls today were built by Muslims, protecting themselves from the Crusaders. Now, they're built, now, what's interesting, and this is a good question, what's interesting is they're built on the same wall line. Just like we have, you know, you don't just put a high, the reason the road doesn't go this way is because there's a hill there, it goes go around. Well, that hill is always there, and so every generation that builds always goes around the hill. And so many of these wall lines are still the same. In fact, again, I'm rambling now, but when they excavate and they got permission to excavate underneath the Damascus Gate, and I've got pictures on my website and pictures in the book, underneath the Damascus Gate, you can see the Damascus Gate. It's a big, magnificent, it's like a killing machine, because there's places to dump boiling oil, there's places to shoot arrows down. You attack this gate, you're just going to get slaughtered. It's a slaughterhouse. That's what Suleiman built to fight off, you know, the Crusades and different, you know, invasions from different people. They went ahead and they excavated down below it and took it down to the first century, to the days of Herod, and now down there. And I went down there and walked on the pavement of the first century. The gates above you from today that you see today from 1517, but now you're down underneath it walking on the pavement from the days of the New Testament. And you see the remains of gates, posts, and things, carvings in the stone. Sometimes you find, like, Roman games that they carved in there while they played. So, again, it's the same wall line, but there's a gate from 1517 on top of the first century gate. Now, this is really almost a slam dunk. You say, well, who knows? There's an eastern gate today built by Suleiman. So when you talk about the eastern gate of Jerusalem, it's like, oh, that's the gate Jesus is going to come in. Could be, whatever. It's probably the right location, but the thing is, that was built by Suleiman, and before that, it was built by the Byzantines. But there has been a couple of incidences that, and it's right now, it's you can't excavate it. They do not want it excavated. They will not let it be excavated. But there's been a couple times where dirt has caved in, and there is, because there's Muslim tombs all along here, on purpose. On purpose. Because now you can't desecrate the tombs. There's been a couple times the dirt has caved in, two different times. And they've gotten snap pictures of it. And below the eastern gate, they've gotten, I'm not making this up, you can find the pictures. It's just, you just can't go and confirm it. You can see the arch of an Old Testament gate. You can see it. You can see it coming down a bit. You only see about this much of it, the stone. It matches stuff that you see up here. So really, we know this gate's here because you walk there and look. Oh, there's the first century gate. They let you excavate it. Is there a gate under here? Yes, but you can't excavate it. So we could potentially have right here Solomon's Eastern Gate. You just can't get to it. So, I mean, that's it's not a slam dunk, but it's pretty close. And that's the way it is all the way along here. All these walls are built on top of other walls. And, when you destroy a city, it becomes rubble, and now the city's higher. You build up walls, the city's destroyed. So that's where you get what we call the tiers, the layers of the different tells. Okay, that's enough for that. I'll try and pick this up here next week. But that's them building the walls. Now we got, again, chapter 4, opposition. When this all gets done, it's like, holy smokes, they're moving through this. The Samaritans have got to move in and stop this. But again, it's not just some Jews. It's Nehemiah with Artaxerxes' seal of approval, financed by the Persian government, with protection by the Persian government, and the Jews are going to get this done. Nehemiah, again, one of the heroes of the Old Testament, because while everybody else is kind of dragging their feet, Nehemiah says, I'll get it done. But he's not just doing it by himself. He's got Artaxerxes' stamp of approval, which is, God uses Nebuchadnezzar. He uses Artaxerxes. He'll use these kings to get certain things done for his people. And it's the same way today. I'll pray, and I do appreciate your patience. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word, and we ask that we may continue to learn these things and understand these things and make comparison to our own times and our own callings, our own lives, as we see these people of faith begin to move and follow your plan. Father, we do thank you for your word. We thank you for your spirit. We thank you for a fellowship we have with other believers. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.